It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Karen Hartglass, and welcome to It's All About Food. We get to talk about my favorite subject, food, for an hour. And for those who are frequent listeners, you know some of the things we talk about how our food choices affect our personal health, the health of the environment, and also the well-being of the other animal species we share our home planet Earth with. It's going to be a very interesting hour. I've got someone I'm a big fan of that we're going to be speaking with today, and I'm hoping we get your thoughts moving and juicing up and make you squirm a little bit. I want to push some buttons and get everybody thinking to make a positive difference in our lives and the lives of the other life forms on this planet. We have with us Gary Francione, who is a distinguished professor of law, and Nicholas DeVee Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University. He has been teaching animal rights and the law for 25 years and has lectured on the topic throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe, including serving as a member of the guest facility of the Universidad Complutense de Madrid, and has been a guest on numerous radio and television shows. He was the co-director with Anna Charlton of the Rutgers Animal Rights Law Center, in which students earned academic credits working on actual legal cases involving animals. Professor Francione is well known among animal advocates for his criticism of the animal welfare position and the property status of non-human animals, and for his abolitionist theory of animal rights. He's written numerous books, including Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation, Animal Rights, Your Child or Your Dog, Animals, Property, and the Law, and his newest book, which he co-authored with Robert Gardner, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. Gary, welcome.
Hi, Karen. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. I don't know that you know this, but you're one of the people in this what do I want to call this animal-vegetable kind of discussion, who's really made things clear for me and made a big impression on me. Gosh, I think it was at Vegetarian Summerfest when it was in Johnstown.
Oh, my, that goes back a ways. You're dating us, Karen. You're dating us.
Well, but, you know, I've heard a lot of people speak, and that talk for me I was already a vegan, so I don't want to say it was a turning point, but there were some. It was unforgettable for me, and I really appreciated your passion, your commitment, your clarity, and listening to you was always, at the very least, very interesting.
Well, you know, I have to tell you that that Johnstown event had an impact like that on you and other people. It also made a lot of people very angry.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry about that, but I spoke it as I saw it, and I'm continuing to do that. But.
Well, I know that this book that you wrote is the animal rights debate. We're not going to have a debate this hour. Maybe that'll make it less interesting, but I totally agree with you on everything.
Well.
So I want to bring up a lot of the issues that are important
okay.
to you.
All right.
Okay. So I'm just curious, how did writing this book, The Animal Rights Debate, come about, and how is it that Robert Gardner agreed to co-author this book with you?
Well,
that was very courageous.
I'm sorry?
It was courageous.
Oh, well, it was interesting, and I think we both enjoyed the experience. What happened was In 1996, I wrote Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement, in which I argued that the animal rights movement was collapsing into an animal welfare movement and that it was ceasing to be an animal rights movement. And in that book, I criticized Robert Garner's position quite a bit because I thought that he was one of the people who was misusing the concept of animal rights and promoting animal welfare reform under the guise of promoting animal rights. Not that he was trying to do anything intentionally wrong, mm-hmm. It's that he was confusing things. The reason why animal rights as a concept developed was to distinguish it from animal welfare. And so to say that animal welfare is consistent with animal rights sort of missed the whole point of trying to have two separate concepts that we could discuss, debate, and decide which was the better paradigm. And so I criticized Robert in that book. And the result was Robert wrote, he then wrote things which were critical of me, and the two of us sort of went back and forth for over a decade criticizing each other in various things that we were writing. And a couple years ago, I wrote him an email and I said, Robert, we've been criticizing each other for a long time, and in our respective writings, why don't we engage each other between the covers of the same book rather than in different books and articles, and why don't we have a debate? And he thought it was a good idea. And Robert's an academic. I mean, he's a professor. He's the chair of the the Department of Politics at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. And he does not run an animal organization. Mm-hmm. It's the people who run the animal organizations who get very, very angry and don't want to engage the idea. Robert has an ideological horse in the race. I'm sorry to use a speciesist expression. I apologize. But he has an ideological horse in the race, but he doesn't have a financial one. It's not part of his business, as it were. So I think he was able to, to look at it in a more dispassionate way. I think the book works pretty well. We engage the ideas. I mean, what we argue in the book is I take the position that we ought to abolish animal exploitation and not regulate it, and that I believe that the way to do that is through creative, nonviolent vegan education. Robert takes the position that Robert's position is a bit complicated, and I'm sorry he's not here discuss it today, but I will try my very hardest to describe it accurately. Robert claims to believe in animal rights, but he believes that animal use itself is not a particularly problematic notion. He believes that animal life, all things being equal, animal life matters less than human life, and he is focused on a right not to suffer. He doesn't really argue for a right not to be used, which is what I argue for. My view is I don't really care how humanely you treat animals. It's wrong to use them, and you should not. We have no moral justification for using them. Robert takes the position that they have a right not to suffer and that we shouldn't use them to the extent that we make them suffer, but if we could use them without making them suffer, then that wouldn't be a particularly problematic position or set of actions to take, to which I respond, it's impossible to use animals without making them suffer, mm-hmm. or causing them distress in some way. It's just absolutely impossible. I mean, you can talk about, for example, one of the things we talk about in the book is the use of animals in experiments. And he's saying, well, if you're using animals in experiments to find important cures for human illnesses and you're not doing anything to harm them, then, you're not subjecting them to any painful procedures, then, what's wrong? And the answer, mm-hmm. is, well, you're keeping them in cages. You're causing them to be distressed. You're causing them to suffer in various ways. There are other ways to suffer other than just the experience of pain.
They're not with their partners or their families.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which animals in laboratories are being deprived, even if you would never touch them. Mm-hmm. And so, same thing with the use of animals for food. I mean, the idea that, we're going to have animals that we regard, that we love as at least some of us love our most dearly beloved non-human companions in our houses, that we're going to treat cows and chickens and sheep that way, and then one day, we're just going to say, okay, we've had this wonderful life together, and now we're going to slaughter and eat you. I mean, that is just, in my judgment, so unrealistic and so crazy, in terms of the possibility of that happening. So what he's arguing in essence is that animals don't have a right not to be used; they have a right not to suffer. I'm arguing that they have a right not to be used at all. however well we treat them, we have that we have an obligation not to use them. And I'd like, I hope we can get into that a little bit few minutes, because I think that's a very
it is very important.
It's key.
And you're talking there's like 100 things I want to say in response, but the first is yes, I agree. I wish I had gotten Robert Garner on as well. I didn't realize until after I finished the book, which was this morning, how good it would have been to have him on. But not necessarily in support of what he had to say. I found that his responses did not have the clarity that yours did, and I really tried to be objective, and maybe I'm not, but I just found the responses confusing because I think they are.
Well, I don't want to comment on that, because I wish Robert were here. I mean,
yeah,
part of
well,
the problem
maybe we'll
was,
bring him back, and we can have a real debate sometime.
I mean, part
in
of the
future.
Problem is he's in England, so there's a five or six mm-hmm. hour time difference. There's a time issue, but I'm sure that if that could be arranged, he would be happy to do it, because he likes talking about this, and he's a really very very nice fellow, and I think he we both believe sincerely what we write about. I mean Robert is very supportive of these welfare reforms and these groups that are doing things like promoting cage-free eggs and abolition of the gestation crate or the veal crate and things like that. I mean, he's into that sort of welfare regulation, and he really in many ways actually I think his position is different from Singer's in a lot of ways, because
tell everyone who
Peter Singer. Peter Singer is a philosopher who wrote the book Animal Liberation in 1976, and basically takes the position, as Robert does, that animals don't have an interest in not being used, that it's a question of how we treat them. But Singer is what we call a utilitarian. He believes that what is right or wrong is a matter of consequences, and he does not believe in rights. The concept of a right, not to get too legalistic or boring, but the concept of a right basically is it protects an interest. A right is a way of protecting an interest, and it says that we're going to protect this interest even if the consequences of doing so are going to be fairly steep and fairly significant. So we can say, well, I have a right to my bodily integrity, which means my interest in my bodily integrity will be protected even if by killing me and taking my organs out you can save 20 people. The consequences of killing me would be good in one sense, in the sense that you would save 20 people, but my interest in my bodily integrity is protected by a right, which means we're not permitted to violate or ignore that interest that I have in my bodily integrity simply because of the good consequences. Singer is a utilitarian who maintains that what we ought to do in any particular circumstance is determined by the consequences of the various actions that we can pursue, and he thinks that we ought to do that which will maximize the best outcome for the largest number of beings involved, human or non-human. And Robert doesn't take that sort of position, but his position in many ways is very, very much like Singer's, in that he's arguing that there's a really important value to be attached to welfare regulation, things like the welfare reforms that are proposed by organizations like the Humane Society of the United States, like PETA, Mercy for Animals, all of these welfare groups, mm-hmm. that basically he believes that these welfare reforms have a very, very high value. And in many ways, Karen, Robert's argument is much better and much more developed than Peter Singer's is in mm-hmm. that respect. I don't really think Peter's really moved the matter forward since he wrote Animal Liberation, really.
When he wrote it in the 70s, it was groundbreaking, and it got the conversation going to a certain extent, and people like yourself and others have been clarifying, building on it since that time.
Well, it's interesting. I'm presently right now, I'm in my home office, and I'm looking at a book called Animals, Men, and Morals that was edited by Stanley and Rosalind Godlevich and John Harris. And it came out, let me look at the, because we all think of Singer as the guy who got the ball rolling. And in many ways,
out before?
This came out in 1971.
Oh.
And when Singer was a graduate student at Oxford at the time, and there were a group of people, graduate students and some young professors, who were meeting and talking about animal ethics, and Peter was part of that group. I'm not sure he's actually even in this book. Let me see. No, he's not. And it's interesting because this book has got some of the fine, I mean, just some terrific essays that were, at the time, really paradigm shifting, and so Singer was exposed to this, and then he went off and wrote Animal Liberation, which in many ways is much more conservative than a lot of the essays in this book, in terms of the both intellectually and substantively, in terms of the direction that he was headed. So in certain ways, he's credited with starting the debate, but in many ways, he was just picking up some interesting things that were going on in England in the late 60s and the early 70s.
Well,
and
I guess we could say that of many, many movements, that there was always something that came before it.
Oh, sure.
The thing that boggles my mind is that how people can say that animals don't think about the future, that animals don't care about their death, or all of these things that we put on them or imagine that they can't possibly think, or that their thoughts are not as valid as ours because we don't know what's going on in their minds.
Well, we don't.
I just have this image of this movie that came out, which I haven't seen, that Richard Gere movie about the dog that he found.
Yes, I actually saw that the other night.
And it's a sappy, happy film, and the guy dies, and the dog waits for him at the train station every day.
Yeah.
That dog was thinking in the future.
Sure. I mean, look, Karen, I'm with you 100% on this. I mean, I'm sitting here right now surrounded by five rescued canines. It's amazing we haven't had any barking outbursts. but we might have one before the end of the time. But I don't have any doubt that animals think differently from the way that humans think, because we are the only beings on Earth that use symbolic communication, language, and so I would imagine that, I mean, our concepts, the way I think, the way you think, are really sort of intimately bound up with these linguistic things called words and various concepts and things. And so I suspect that their concept, I mean, the way they think is relevantly different because they don't use language. But it's also absolutely clear to me that they have some sort of equivalence. I mean, the idea that they don't think about the future. I mean, I don't think that dogs sit around, or any other animal sit around, saying, "Well, gee, you know, I'm 12, and you know, the average age of a dog my weight is 15 years, so I got another 3 years left to go. So maybe I'd like to go live in Europe for this time, or maybe I'm pretty sure that they don't think that way. I have a border collie, and they're scary. So you never know what's going on with them. I'm pretty sure they don't think that way. But who cares? I mean, why? What I don't understand is, and this is a real big issue with between me and Singer, and it's interesting because a number of people have been trying to set up debates between me and Singer to discuss precisely this sort of thing, and Singer won't do it. I mean, he simply refuses to engage this issue. But it's fairly clear to me that this idea that the only way that animals don't have an interest in continuing to live, this is a position that Peter takes, and it comes from actually Jeremy Bentham, which is the philosopher, the 18th century philosopher, that a 19th century philosopher actually, who Peter Singer bases most of his work on, and Bentham took the position that animals mattered because they could suffer, but he said it was all right for us to use them because they didn't care that we used them; they only cared about how we treated them. And Singer picks this up. And actually, this is a position that most of these animal ethics philosophers take, including Tom Reagan, who takes a rights position. Reagan has that, Reagan's position is different from Singer's, certainly in a lot of respects, but Reagan takes this position that if a dog and a human is, if they're on the lifeboat and you got to throw one of them out, you should throw out the dog because the dog has fewer opportunities for satisfaction than the human does. As a factual matter, I mean, I just think that that's false. it's a very appealing idea to theoreticians about this issue, that this idea that animals don't think the same way we do, so their lives are of lesser moral value.
Right.
And that's where I have a serious problem, because as far as I'm concerned,
because we can't prove it, so any argument based on it doesn't hold.
But what if we found out? I'm perfectly happy to say animals don't think the way we do. But my next point is, who cares?
Right.
Why is that relevant?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care how they.
Well, because we want to say that we are better because we think a certain way.
Oh, I understand why we do it.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly understand why we do it, but that doesn't mean it's okay or that it has any validity. I mean, I think that many non-human animals have very sophisticated cognition. That is, they have very sophisticated mental abilities. But my view is, I don't really care. I don't really think, for example, I don't think that great apes matter more than dogs or fish,
mm-hmm.
or that elephants matter more than dogs or fish or rats. My view is that if a being is sentient, that's the sentience is the perceptual awareness. If as long as a being is perceptually aware that the ability, then I can say two things about that being. A, that being has an interest in her continued existence, because the fact that she's sentience is a means to the ends of continued existence. And so if as long as she's sentient, then I have no doubt that she has an interest in continuing to live. To say she's sentient but that she does not have an interest, that is, she does not prefer or desire or want to continue to live, is crazy in my view.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I can make a very good argument, which I do in this book and some others that I've written, at least I try to make a very good argument, that we can't morally justify treating beings who are sentient as our resources.
Mm-hmm.
And see, this is where I really think this is a key issue in the debate that I had with Robert Garner in our book, is Garner defends Singer's position and says that, all other things being equal, humans have a greater moral value than non-humans. And so if you got as far as the third section of the book when we were doing the actual debating part,
mm-hmm.
I kept on pushing him on it and saying, well, does that mean that a human being who is more intellectually, if you have two human beings, and one is very intellectually sophisticated and the other is very not very sophisticated, does that mean that the life of the person who is more intellectually sophisticated is worth more than the life of the person who's less sophisticated? And I really couldn't get him to answer that question.
Yeah.
And he kept on saying, well, there's still going to be huge differences between even a person with a human with a lot of deficiencies and a lot of inadequacies, or somebody who's severely disabled or whatever, and an animal. And the answer is, first of all, that's not true. But secondly, it misses the theoretical point that if you don't want to be a speciesist about it, and if you want to take the position that sophistication of cognition is what gives meaning to life and value, moral value to life, then you've got to do that within the human species as well as between the human species and other species.
Peter Singer did that.
I understand that, Singer. Yes,
now, I'm not saying it's right, but if you're going to do that, you should do it all the way.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Singer, on one level, he does say that you can talk about the value of humans relative to other humans, but he has a default position. He basically says that we don't treat humans as a general matter as replaceable resources, and that it's all right for us to treat non-humans as replaceable resources. Well, once you've set up those two different starting positions, then even if you have a theory that says, well, you can make distinctions amongst or between human beings for purposes of moral value, you're not really going to do that, because you're going to have a default principle that you're working with that says, if something is human, then we don't treat that thing as a replaceable resource because of its because of its species characteristics, which again begs the question. So yes, I agree with you. To some degree, Singer will take the step that Garner is reluctant to take and say, yes, I will make distinctions amongst or between human beings for purposes of moral value. But on the other hand, he sets up a principle that basically means he's not going to do that. I think the thing that's really important here is one can get lost in the theory, and I don't want people to do that. This is really a very simple thing, and I try to bring this out in the book. We all agree it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering and death on animals. Everybody who's listening to this, everybody you and I and everybody else will meet today, tonight, tomorrow, next week, whatever, agrees with that. Now, we could have an interesting philosophical discussion, which we don't need to have, about what necessity means, but if it means anything, it means that we can't justify inflicting pain, suffering, and death on non-human animals for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. So if we start off with, it's wrong to inflict unnecessary pain, suffering, and death on sentient beings, and that if necessity means anything, it means we can't do that for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. Well, if we look at our use of animals for food or for clothing or whatever, you know, we're killing 56 billion animals a year, every year for food, and that doesn't include fish. Now, what is the best justification we have for that? It's certainly not necessary for health reasons. I mean, nobody maintains anymore. I mean, that it's necessary for humans to eat any animal products to lead an optimally healthy life. I've been a vegan for almost 30, I've been vegan for 28, 29 years now, and I'm still going pretty strong. You don't need to eat any animal products to lead an optimally healthy lifestyle. I would say that the evidence is mounting that it's detrimental to human health. But even if you don't want to take that step, you certainly can't make a good argument that it's necessary, that you'll be healthier if you eat animal products, number one. Number two, animal products are an environmental, ecological disaster. Yeah, and so what you're left with is our best justification for inflicting pain, suffering, and death on 56 billion animals a year, every year for food, not counting fish, is that they taste good. And see, to me, once you sort of explain it to people that way and you say, look, everybody was all upset with Michael Vick. Why? Because he was sitting around watching dogs fight. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's terrible what Michael Vick did, but how the hell is Michael Vick any different from anybody who is consuming any animal products whatsoever, meat, dairy, ice cream, cheese, it doesn't really matter, because the reason why we objected to what Michael Vick did was because it wasn't necessary. He was sitting around enjoying he was sitting around the pit watching dogs fight. The rest of us sit around the barbecue pit and roast corpses of animals that have been treated every bit as badly, if not worse, than the animals that Michael Vick fought.
I think a lot of people might know that internally, but they justify it by saying, I need to eat, and they don't acknowledge that they don't need to eat animals.
No, well, I agree. I think in a lot of ways, you know, what I find when I talk about this issue publicly is, you know, I will, depending on who I'm talking to, if I'm talking to a university philosophy class, then I will talk about certain things. But, you know, when I'm talking just generally, I think this is really a very simple idea. We don't need to get lost in theory here. There are some very, very simple ideas. and if you take animal interest seriously, if you care about animals, and if you take morality seriously, then I hate to say this, but you don't really have a heck of a lot of choice. I mean, you know, to say that, well, I care about animals and I take morality seriously, but I'm going to go out and eat a hamburger, those are simply not consistent statements.
Absolutely, and I care about the environment, but I don't make the connection between
animal agriculture and global warming. We would all think it would be crazy if somebody were to say, look, I really care about children, and I really do. I mean, I really care about the welfare of children, and I'm now going to go out and purchase child pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would say, geez, you know, that's somebody who is suffering from serious delusion. Well, I think it's similar with animals. You know, to say I really care about animals and I take morality seriously, but I'm going to go out and consume ice cream or a cheese pizza or a steak.
And denial is not just a river in Egypt.
Yes, exactly.
Gary, we need to take a 2-minute break. So
sure.
Go and chat with your canine friends, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Okay.
Very good. Thanks.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Is someone driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, and I'm here with Gary Francione, and we're talking about the animal rights debate, abolition or regulation. Okay, roll 'em. Where were we?
Oh, well, that was like ages ago. Yeah. 2 minutes can be a lifetime.
I know. So, you know, I just want to talk a little bit about the animal welfare organizations. There's
sure.
the Humane Society, there's PETA, there's Mercy for Animals, you mentioned. And I don't want to put them down, but there are a number of things that they do that I'm not comfortable with in supporting. And a lot of it has to do with the things that they promote, the campaigns that they have to improve the welfare of animals. Things like putting an animal in a slightly larger cage. And there's a lot of people support them. A lot of people feel good about it. They give their money, and there's a lot of energy and time that gets spent on these really tiny, incremental little things that really are an improvement. And and you slightly mentioned it in the book. I don't want to mention any names, but something that also surprises me is that some of my staunch vegan peers who now work there at the Humane Society have softened their stand
they're more accepting of the welfare position, and really surprises me, and I wonder what's behind that. Do they really believe that that's the best? Are they wrapped up in the power of this big organization?
Well, you know, there's a... It's complicated. I mean, I think
it's complicated.
You know, I don't think it's, you know, I don't think you can just sort of say, well, they're not sincere people, because I don't think, you know, it may be true of some of them. I don't know, but I mean, I don't think that that's true of
mm-hmm.
all of them. I think that, you know, people talk themselves into all sorts of situations that, you know, they really shouldn't talk themselves into, because I mean, look at it this way. I mean, these are large organizations. They bring in huge amounts of money. They want to continue to have, I mean, they have an economic incentive to have a very, very large donor base. And so the way that you have a very large donor base is by creating these single issue campaigns, whether it's gestation crates, you know, getting rid of gestation crates, or Proposition 2, or veal crate issues, or, you know, cage free egg issues, or anti-fur issues and things like that. So you package and sell these single issue campaigns, and that's easy. It's easy to do fundraising with those devices. The problem with them, and this is something I've been working on and writing about for longer than I care to think about, but for, you know, since the mm-hmm. early 90s, I've been talking about the fact that animals are chattel property. Animals have no intrinsic value whatsoever, or inherent value, or moral value. They only have value that we give them as commodities. And, I mean, look, I love our five dogs. I mean, I regard them as members of my family. When, you know, when my dogs die, I grieve, and I love them, and I value them very highly. But the reality is, the law regards them as property. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to keep them all outside all the time, if I wanted to, as long as I gave them minimal shelter and fed them and gave them water, I could do that. If I wanted to beat them because they weren't good guard dogs, I could do that. The law protects that. So I mean, I think that we have to understand animals are property, you know, and cows and pigs and chickens, you know, they're all property. And so when you're going to protect their interests, it's going to cost money to protect their interests. And the only time that we're going to do that is when we get an economic benefit from protecting the interest, or else you have all sorts of economic problems with the marketing of meat and dairy products. And if you look at the history of animal welfare reforms, they're basically things which actually make the production of meat and animal products more efficient. I mean, look, for example, the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958, where, you know, the United States government required that large animals be stunned before they're shackled and hoisted. Why was that particular welfare reform passed? It was passed because when you have a cow hanging upside down that weighs 2,000 pounds and she's moving around a lot because she's scared, she's very frightened and she's suffering, she hits workers and she causes worker injuries. And she incurs carcass damage, which decreases the value of her as meat. So industry will go along with having a rule requiring stunning. Yeah, they'll go along with that because that's going to cut down on worker injuries and carcass damage, and so that's actually going to increase production efficiency. I mean, interestingly, PETA and the Humane Society are now trying to, they're arguing that chicken suppliers ought to be gassing chickens rather than electrically stunning them. And if you look at the literature that PETA and HSUS is producing, they're basically arguing that if you use controlled atmosphere killing or the gassing of these birds, it's actually it's economically beneficial to do so. And in
mm-hmm.
fact, if you, Karen Hartglass, decided, well, you know, you're having a real change of heart and tomorrow you want to go out and start a chicken slaughterhouse, you would be crazy not to use controlled atmosphere killing, because it's much more economically efficient. So in the first place, a lot of these welfare reforms that organizations like PETA and HSUS promote are simply things that industry will eventually do anyway
mm-hmm.
because they're economically efficient. And also, there's a value to industry fighting with PETA and HSUS about these things, because it's like a kabuki dance. I mean, so they're sort of off in this little dramatic sort of, you know, exchange and sort of, you know, arguing with each other, and it looks like there's a real conflict there. there when eventually Purdue and all these other producers are going to eventually, they're going to go to controlled atmosphere
killing.
Because
it's cost-effective.
Mm-hmm. It's cost-effective. It's the same thing with the gestation crates. I mean, I get a kick out of these organizations that are promoting the abolition of the gestation crate. The gestation crate is disappearing because it's economically a very bad idea. There are alternatives like electronic self-feeding, which are much more economically efficient. So, you know, they have all these campaigns, and they put a lot of money and time and energy into these things, but they give people, you know, we live in a culture, Karen, where people want an instant, you know, they want instant gratification. So they say, well, you know, gee, there's so much animal suffering. I've got to do something now to help animals. And so I'm going to support these welfare reforms. And the answer is, you're not going to do anything to help animals now. If anything, what you're going to do is you're going to contribute to what I regard as the most pernicious phenomenon in terms of the animal welfare movement, which is making people feel better about consuming animals. I mean, you look at all mm-hmm. these organizations now mm-hmm. are promoting the Whole Foods Animal Compassionate Standard. We have, you know, we have the Humane Choice label that Humane that the HSUS is promoting, and they're also promoting Certified Humane Raising Hand, whatever. There's at least a dozen of these labels out there now.
Well, I know a lot of people that I'm associated with are buying more free range eggs, and they feel better
sure.
about it. And yet
sure.
the free range label is practically meaningless.
It's absolutely meaningless. And number one, and number two, those are people who, if you educated them properly, would stop eating the eggs altogether.
Right.
And see, and this is where I think people are really missing the educational boat. Instead of focusing on vegan education, they're saying, oh, no, no, we've got to encourage people to you know, eat cage-free eggs or you know, happy pork or happy beef or whatever they're trying to promote. That is, all that's doing, that's counterproductive. It's making things worse. It's not making things better. Think about it. You know, if you explain to someone, if you explain the various moral arguments to people, the you know the health issues, the environmental issues, if someone's not going to go vegan, then they're going to take some other step.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine if that's what they're going to do, but why encourage them to? I mean, you know, I will, when I give a talk, someone will say to me, well, I'm going to give up meat, but I can't give up dairy, and I always say, look, you know, dairy, there's as much suffering, if not more suffering, in a glass of milk than there's a pound of steak. If I had to consume one or the other and I were making my decision simply based on suffering, I'd probably end up eating the steak because animals using dairy are kept alive longer. They're treated every bit as badly as meat
animals. Milk is more of a health issue than meat.
Well, I think it's certainly more of a health issue, but it's certainly, in my judgment, dairy products are as responsible for as much suffering and death as meat products. So if somebody says to me, well, I'll give up meat, but I'm not going to give up dairy, I always say to them, look, you can't draw a line between flesh and other animal products. You know, they're all the same. They're all products of exploitation, all products of suffering, all products of death. And then I'll say, but look, you know, if that's what you want to do, do it. But keep in mind that you're drawing a morally incoherent line rather than saying to them, oh, that's great. Go and become a vegetarian, and that's great, and then you're satisfying your moral obligations to animals. I think that's the wrong way to go. As a matter of fact, I wrote an essay for this on this for the Vegan Society in Britain, I guess last year. I don't know, it's on my website, and it's called Vegetarianism First, and I take issue with, and I discuss this in the book with Garner as well, that, you know, I take issue with this idea that we ought to be promoting vegetarianism. I think that that's a crazy thing to do. To me, promoting vegetarianism and not promoting veganism is as crazy as saying, well, we should not eat the meat from spotted cows, but we ought to eat the meat from brown cows or something. I mean, it's a crazy place
to
draw a line.
Knowing all that I know now after 30 plus years of eating plants, I definitely agree with you, but at the time when I was putting it all together, I was a teenager. I was motivated by not wanting to kill animals and not knowing any more than that, and then went through this journey of learning and making decisions.
Yeah, but that was 30 years ago.
That was 30 years ago. Now there's a lot more information. We have the internet, and I definitely think people can make the leap and make the connections. And I really believe that it's up to each of us as individuals to make a change. There was a comment by Robert Garner in your book, I'm not exactly sure what it was, but something about the importance of regulating and making laws in order to make change happen. But then at some point he also said that the laws won't change unless, you know, people's thoughts change. And so that it all comes back to each of us as individuals, and that's where the education comes in, which is so important. But the education needs to be just all around us. And how do we make that happen? It has to be on television. It has to be in the papers. It has to be in the schools. It has to, because a lot of us, unfortunately, are like sheep. And again, I don't want to use a species expression. But I think we all understand what I mean. And the thing is, a lot of us tend to go with the flow. My mom's got three vegan kids, and she frequently says, you know, if it was easier, if all my friends were doing it, I could do it. So the question is, you know, how do we get more of that information out there? I mean, it's happening slowly, but will it happen completely and soon enough?
Well, soon enough. That's an interesting question.
Soon enough,
the exploitation of animals is the most pervasive form of discrimination on the planet. I mean, with sexism coming second, actually. All forms of discrimination are related. Racism, sexism, heterosexism, sexism, speciesism, they're all related. But speciesism is a very serious, pervasive problem. We don't even part of the problem is we don't even recognize it's a problem.
That's right.
So I think one of the great tragedies, I think, is the amount of money and time and effort that goes into promoting welfare reform. If you took, I remember, Karen, in the 1980s, going back to the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
And I remember being in meetings with leaders of the animal movement when things were being discussed about whether or not the movement, because it was much smaller back then, and you could get all the leaders of the movement in a large room, and the discussions about whether or not people should support the 1985 amendments to the Animal Welfare Act, for example. And I remember saying then, listen, why don't we just stop all this nonsense, and why don't we just put all of our time and energy into creative, nonviolent vegan education?
Mm.
And I really believe had we done that then,
yeah,
we would have many, many more vegans, and we would have a political movement that was based on the idea that animals are just, you know, sort of, they're not things. They're not things for us to exploit. We would have a political movement that rejected this form of violence.
Well, factory farming would not have gotten the stronghold that it has now.
Well, I mean, by the 1980s, factory farming was pretty much, factory farming really developed in the 1940s, and it got, you know, it was, in, by the 1960s, it was pretty much an entrenched part of American agriculture. It was a pretty much entrenched part of American agriculture, but certainly it wouldn't have gotten, what's happened in the past, the past 20, 25 years, we have really very little to show for all of the time and the money that's been spent. There's really very little to show. I don't really think we've made progress. As a matter of fact, I think we're going backward. I think this whole happy meat movement is a very serious step backward. I think the continued and the relentless sexism and the failure to see that these are related issues of violence, that our violence toward non-human animals is really based in our violent culture as a general matter, and that we need to take a step back and sort of look at violence as a general matter.
Well, the question is, what does humane really mean? When people use the word humane,
sure,
I think about what humans do to humans. Is that humane? It's violent sometimes.
Yes, it certainly is, and I agree with you, and I think that one of the unfortunate things that's happened in the past decade is, we're otherizing more and more groups of people. And, once you otherize somebody, whether it's women or Muslims or non-human animals or whoever it is you otherize, then you can justify doing just anything you want to do to that group of people. And so, I think that there are lots of, there are fundamental moral issues here that we are sort of missing as a species. And part of it is, we'll stand in line, to get the next version of the iPhone or whatever, whatever gadget we want, or the next iteration of one of these television games that people play on their televisions. So people will stand in line for a day to overnight or for 2 days to get those things. But we're not really, morality and moral issues are sort of falling off of the radar screen.
Yep.
And that's a very serious, I think that's a very, very serious, and in many ways it's sort of different The young people are coming of age in a society that is really very different from the one that you and I came of age in, even though it wasn't that long a time ago. It may seem like it, but it wasn't really that long a time ago. But I think when we were younger people and we were in college and, you know, we were in high school and in college and stuff, there was much more idealism and much more of a focus on morality. That's being commodified out and sort of just ignored, and I think that that's a very, very serious thing. And to the extent that that's happening, it's not just it's not just a question of what the impact it has on animals. I mean, it's the impact it has as a general matter, and it's really quite serious. I mean, this is one of the things that I find deeply disturbing when I'm having conversations with animal advocates, and they don't understand that the sexism of some of these animal organizations, mm-hmm. I mean, I'd rather go naked than wear fur and all this sort of nonsense, this is very, very serious. I mean, as long as we're commodifying women, we're going to certainly continue to commodify animals. I mean, the one thing that you can say for sure is, when you're commodifying members of your own species, it's going to be real hard for you to see that commodifying members of other species is really problematic. And so the idea that, well, we're going to make progress, that we're going to somehow make progress on the animal issue by continuing to commodify women is just plain nuts. And I remember in the 1980s when these things were starting, and I remember saying, having a conversation with Ingrid Newkirk, in which I said, Ingrid, you know, the I'd rather go naked than wear fur campaign is not going to have a bit of influence. It's not going to, and the proof's in the vegan pudding, Karen. I mean, it's now how many years later, and the fur industry is as strong as it's ever been.
That's right.
And worldwide, I mean, worldwide, the fur industry is as strong as it's ever been. I mean, the anti-fur campaign is a perfect example of how single-issue campaigns simply don't work.
I mean, you know, whenever I see people campaigning against fur, it's just crazy because that is leather okay? And my friends that don't go to stores that sell fur, but they'll still go to stores that sell wool and sell leather. People are missing the point.
Look, there are a lot of animal people who will go and walk up to a woman on the street who's mm-hmm. wearing a fur coat and say some really insulting and upsetting things to those people.
That's not
to
the
those
way to make
women.
Change.
Yes, while they're wearing a wool coat, they'll be doing that.
Oh.
And I have seen that happen more times than I wish I did. I have these bizarre discussions with animal advocates who seem to think that, well, leather's just a byproduct, but fur isn't. And the answer is no, leather's not a byproduct, number one. Number two, that's not the point. The point is you can't, you know, it doesn't really make much sense to focus on fur and suggest that somehow that's a more odious moral violation than wool or silk or leather. It's not.
Yeah, well, it's all down to those single issues, and it's because these nonprofit organizations are always looking for the next sexy campaign to bring money in to support the organization, and that would all be well and good if they were really making a difference. And, you know, it makes me think of some of the disease foundations, like those that are trying to fight cancer or whatever. They do the same thing. And yet we're no better off in curing cancer. And yet they'll have these big fundraisers and they'll serve all kinds of unhealthy food when we know that the majority of cancers could be prevented with a healthy plant-based diet. And so it happens everywhere because these organizations want to keep going. And I think the goal of most nonprofits would be to put themselves out of business because they would be solving the issue that they're trying to work for.
That's how they all start. You know what? They all end up. I mean, the larger they get, the more they start to resemble each other. And so now there are a group of animal organizations in this country that are largely indistinguishable. I mean, they're just basically all the same.
Yep.
They all take the same positions. They all promote the same campaigns. You wonder, you know, I mean, the primary difference between these organizations is they sell different T-shirts. And that's the primary difference. And I really, one of the things that I find very disturbing is their inability and their reluctance to try to engage these issues in anything remotely resembling a coherent collegial or professional way. It's impossible to get them to discuss these issues. They will not debate these issues. They won't debate the ineffective. I mean, there are issues here. if I'm wrong about what I say about welfare reform, that is, I take the position that it's ineffective and that it's counterproductive, if I'm wrong, then it'd be great to hear why I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. They won't do it. They simply will not engage the issues. And I mean, you know, if I'm wrong about the idea, the philosophical idea that animals have to have minds like ours in order to have an interest in continuing to live, if that's wrong, if my theories and everything I've written about that is wrong, I'd like to hear about why it's wrong. And this is the problem. They won't engage. You know, they won't engage. Now, I'm hoping my friend Gene Bauer from Farm Sanctuary, I got an email a couple weeks ago indicating that he wanted to have a discussion with me about these issues, and I'm delighted to do that.
Right.
And I wrote back to Gene the very next day. As a matter of fact, I think I got it late at night tonight. By the time I wrote to him, it was the next day, but it was only probably 2 hours later. And I wrote back to him, and I said, absolutely. So I have invited Gene to come to Rutgers and have a debate that will be moderated about these issues, or I have offered him the option of having a podcast and doing that, and again, having moderation. And I have suggested some people, including Robert Garner, as somebody who could moderate the debate, and or somebody else that Gene would like. And so I'm hoping that Gene made that offer. I assume he made that offer in good faith, and I'm waiting to hear back from him. Although it's been a couple weeks since he initially proposed it, and I accepted, and we don't have an agreement yet as to how we're going to do this. But that will really be a very good thing, because it will be an opportunity
Absolutely.
For someone who heads up one of these large corporations, these large animal protection corporations, to sort of deal with these criticisms and. To the extent I'm wrong, or that he thinks that I'm wrong, or my perspective is wrong, I want to be educated as much as anyone else does, and I would sort of like, you know, I think it would be very useful for the public and for animal advocates to hear these sorts of discussions, and I wish there were more of them. And to the extent that you can have them on your radio show, I'm ready anytime you are.
Okay, well, definitely want to have you back. We have about a minute left. I wanted to say I really think the big issue is. Economics. Most of the decisions that have occurred in this country have been economic related. Even the wars that we've gone into, people like to think that we have some altruistic motive, but it's always been based on economics. And unfortunately, I don't think we'll have any significant change unless we can show that it's going to be more economically efficient or cost effective.
Well, you know, or it gets to the point where economic efficiency has pushed so many people to the edge and has destroyed their sense of well-being and their sense of a good life, that there is a real pushback against that, and that may very well happen. I mean, look at the fact that what's happening in this country right now, how many people are losing their homes, how many people don't have jobs. You know, that could result in some significant change, and I think we need to be hopeful about that. I would encourage people who are interested in this issue, on the rights versus welfare issue and the general relationship of human rights and animal rights and the problems with violence as a general matter, take a look at the website that I have. It's called www.abolitionistapproach.com. And I've got blog essays there. I've got videos. I've got all sorts of things that people can take a look at and better educate themselves on these issues. And I hope that they will.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank
Francione.
You so much, Karen. It's been great talking with you again. I hope that you're well, and I look forward to doing a future show with you.
Absolutely. Gary Francione, the co-author of The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. Again, his website is abolitionistapproach.com. Thanks for listening. Have a delicious week.